Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. And you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Oh, doing very good. We're at an unusual time tonight, and I believe we've got a few people in the chat room, although I'm having some sort of glitch with chat, so I'm not seeing really what's being typed there. Apparently this is our glitch for the evening. I can't see chat, so I can see who's there, but not, you know, what's going on. So anyway, to those of you in the chat, if you're seeing me there and not knowing why I'm not typing back to you, that's why. So anyway, now how are you doing tonight, Phil?
Well, you know, I've had a really interesting week, and I've got a story that I need to relate to you about my travels, actually, before we go into our topics for this evening. So if you'll indulge me, I think this is kind of an interesting story. As you know, I'm in California, and that's the reason that the show is at an unusual time tonight. I had work-related conflicts that went into the evening, so I appreciate you, Stephen, staying up late so we can do a Halloween show. It's kind of nice to do a Halloween show late at night, right? That seems
exactly.
Seems appropriate. So here's what happened. Monday, I went to the airport fully intending I had some things I needed to do in the afternoon, calls I needed to be on and so forth. So I had scheduled my day so that I could be, I could arrive in San Francisco by about 1 o'clock, and I get to the office probably by about 2:30 at the latest. I get to Denver International Airport, and I'm, you know, shuffling things. I'm, you know, doing things, getting my bag. I've got a, I don't do a carry-on bag anymore. I always check a bag just because I have, like, medications and stuff I carry with me, and I'm just tired of arguing with TSA about them. So I've given up, and I'm like, I always check a bag. So I go, and I check my bag, and I've been rearranging things. Here's my car keys. Want to make sure I know where those are. Here's my Bluetooth headset. I want to make sure I know where that is. Everything's in its place. I've got my boarding pass. I've got my ID. I'm all set to get into the security line. And I'm like, okay, now all I need to do is get my phone out of my pocket, put that in my bag, because I don't want to have that go beep when I go through the scanner. And lo and behold, I'm going to use the word precious, is not on my person, okay? I'm suddenly like, what the heck? Where is my iPhone? And, you know, it's a kind of a panicky feeling, I have to say. I'm like, well, clearly I've already stuck it in my computer bag. So I completely searched my computer bag, I mean, more thoroughly than I, you know, I found all kinds of pouches and slots and stuff. And it's like, no, I was fumbling with that stuff, but I did not put it in my bag. And I'm thinking, well, I went and checked the bag, and I do that with the Skycaps outside because the line is shorter. So obviously when I went up and talked to those guys, I set my phone down on the counter and left it there. So I went up there, the guy's like, nope, no phones. So I'm thinking, what the heck happened to this phone? And then I remembered, oh, I know what happened. I set everything down so that I could put my car keys away and all this kind of fumbling I was doing in the first instance. I must have put the iPhone down on the ground. I couldn't imagine actually doing that because it was just like, you know, you're so aware of it whenever you make that thing touch a surface that it's not supposed to be on, you know, at least I am. I mean, this is like an extension of myself. You know, the idea that I would have set that down and not realize it. It's just bizarre to me. But it had to have happened because it's not in my bag. So I retrace my steps. I go back to where I was. No sign of it. Back to my car. I know it's not in my car because I actually had seen a call coming in. It was a blocked call, and I didn't take it. And that had occurred somewhere between parking the car and getting into the terminal. So I'm like, I have lost my phone. I'm just beside myself thinking, well, I don't know how to do a lot of things now. Right? You know, I've only had the thing for about a year. But I'm like, I don't know how to call certain people. I can't check my email. I can't tell anyone that I've lost my phone because my phone would be the only way I'd be able to do it. And it occurs to me, oh, wait, someone has found my phone, right? Obviously, someone picked up my phone. I set it down, and somebody picked it up. So all I have to do, I've seen this on TV, I call my phone. If I call my phone, they'll answer. They'll tell me where they are. I'll come get my phone. So, you know, this is all while I don't give myself that much of a margin to make a flight, okay? So this is at significant time to what I would normally take to the airport. So I find a payphone, which that takes a minute because when's the last time you look for a payphone, right? And then I'm like,
exactly.
Change. Yeah, you know. And I call my phone, no answer. Wait a few minutes, call my phone again, no answer. Wait a few minutes, call my phone, no answer. And then it occurred to me, oh, I know what had to have happened is I put my phone into my check bag. And so it's safely on its way to the plane. Like, that's got to be what happened. Nothing else makes any sense. So I get in the security line, go through the endless security line, get on the train, get to almost to my gate, come up the escalator, heading towards my gate, and I hear something that, you know, you don't hear that much at the airport anymore. They're paging somebody. They used to do that all the time, but now everybody has mobile phones. They don't page people. And you know what name I hear? Phil Bauermaster, please pick up a white courtesy phone. Phil Bauermaster, please stop by the information desk or pick up a white courtesy phone. I'm like, hey, this is it. Someone has definitely found my phone. So I go to the information desk. They're like, yes, your phone has been turned into lost and found. And ponder this one with me for a moment, Stephen. If somebody found your phone, would they know it's your phone?
I don't know how they would.
Go ahead.
You know what? I think, though, they might, because actually I think it's labeled somewhere within the operating system, you know, Stephen Gordon's phone, iPhone or something. But,
well,
you know, I think in the setup, in the original setup of the phone, if somebody knew what they were doing and could dig into the operating system, they could get that. But, yeah, but is that how they did it? Or how did they figure out it was yours?
Well, that's exactly the thing. I'm thinking, wow. What incredible service at DIA. Not only did they find my phone, they knew how to get my name out of it, and they paged me to make sure I got my phone back before I got on my flight. I'm so impressed now by Denver International Airport staff and their competence that it doesn't even bother me that my flight's leaving in about 20 minutes, and now I'm on the train going the wrong way. I go to Lost and Found, and I say, you know, they paged me. They said they found my phone. The guy's like, oh, yeah, here it is. And I said, any idea who turned it in, how you knew it was my phone? He goes, nope, it was just sitting here, and they said, it's got your name on it. So, you know, I'm not one to – I don't have time to stop and question because I have to go back through security line. I get in the security line, and I'm behind what I'm going to generously describe as there's some kind of offshoot Amish, okay? So they've never flown before, but they wear a lot of metal, okay? And I swear there's like 15 of them, and every single one of them had no idea what to do, and every single one of them went through the scanner and beeped it. You know, and I'm just like, all the time, I'm like, I've got 4 minutes. I've got 3 minutes.
No way you're going to make this flight, yeah.
I'm never going to make it. And just as I finally got to the front of the line, I hear this, sir, please step aside, and a wheelchair comes through. So, I'm just being as cool as I possibly can because the important thing is I got my phone, right? So I'm not going to get bent out of shape with anybody about any of this kind of stuff. Finally get through security, finally get on the train, get back to my concourse, get to my gate, and actually see the plane backing away, which, you know, that's like one of those, it's like a scene from a movie, right? And I've had that happen to me once before, probably about 14 years ago, where you get to the gate just as they're really starting to make progress, pulling it back, and it's like, well, okay, I missed that flight. Ended up on standby for a later flight, and then finally just went ahead and booked the seat on a somewhat later flight because, you know, you get this thing, it's like, well, the entire workday is going to be gone, right? I mean, I do need to get there at some point. And the great thing is, if you're at an airport, here's what I finally figured out about the whole experience. I'm much better off at an airport with my laptop and free Wi-Fi and my phone than I would be at the office without my phone. I don't want to be anywhere without my phone. That's the bottom line. It's almost impossible to imagine living without it. And I never used to be one of those people. I used to carry just a regular phone, not a smartphone, and I could take it or leave it. You know, it was just this annoyance that I had to make calls on sometimes. I didn't really do anything with it. Now I think all my contacts are in there. I do email on it. I check my work email. I check my Gmail. I send text messages. It's like this, literally like this extension of myself. And truly, kind of a frightening few moments there when I was like, this thing might really be gone. I might really have to replace this, and I might actually have to, this is the scary part, survive 2, 3, 4 days, maybe even a week, without it or a replacement. And I'll tell you, it was that was an intense couple of moments. So anyway, I got all that arranged, and this is just to show you the day I was having, okay? So I'm like, I'm going to make lemonade out of this. So, you know, I'm going to go find a nice place to sit down. I got the Wi-Fi. I'll get as much work done as I can. I'll catch that flight a little later. But the first thing I'm going to do, something I haven't done at the airport in a long time because I'm always in such a hurry, get my shoes shined, right? I'm like, I got to do training later this week. I'm going to get a shoe shine. Haven't done that in a while. Sat down, got the shoe shine, had this great chat with this young woman who was shining my shoes. Got up, then had a couple calls to make. I'm making calls, getting ready to have my day go well, and this guy walks up and he goes, excuse me, sir, did you leave your bag someplace? And I'm like, what? And sure enough, when I got up from the shoe shine place, I had left my laptop bag just sitting there because I wanted, you know, I'm like so enamored with my phone that I forgot to carry my computer with me, so.
This was just the trip where everything just, everything went wrong, I guess, huh?
Everything went wrong, but worked out okay. That was
the. Yeah, you know, and you're the guy that travels all the time too, Phil. I mean, that what makes that funny, you know?
Well, yeah. it's the strangest thing that I never do these things. You know, I never just leave my phone. I certainly would never leave my laptop. I was having one of those days. Later, I get on the phone with my wife after I get to San Francisco, and she tells me, "So here's what happened. All this great service from Denver International Airport." No, I don't think that would have happened. That phone would have sat there in Lost and Found for a long time. I never even thought to go to Lost and Found. You know, it would not have occurred to me that it would be there within that time frame. I thought maybe on the way back I'd hit Lost and Found if nothing else worked out. But I get on the phone with my wife. She's like, "Oh yeah, this woman called me and said she had found your phone, and she had to go catch a flight, so she didn't know what to do with it. And of course, there's no way to contact me because I don't have my phone." So my wife, you know, she's thinking, and she's like, "Well, I don't know I'm not sure what the right answer here is." The woman says, "Well, look, I got no time. I'm going to drop it at Lost and Found, so you can let him know that it's there," and hangs up. And my wife's like, "Yeah, okay, except for the part where I let him know it's there because I have no way of contacting him because you've got his phone." So she calls the airport and gets them to page me. And then it turns out that a good friend of mine in Austin, Texas, called me yesterday afternoon and said, "So you got your phone back?" And I'm like, "How do you know about this?" And he said, "Well, I guess somebody had found your phone and called your wife, couldn't get a hold of her because she had actually left voicemail with my wife the first time. And so she just started working down the list, and there was his name. So she called him, and he said the same thing. I'll tell you what, leave it at Lost and Found, I'll page him." So I had, like, people all over the country calling the paging desk at Denver International Airport saying, "Please page this guy so we can get his phone back from..."
What that weird call I got from that lady was about. Okay, all right. I told her, just check in the trash. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's the weird not thing. She said she found it by a trash container. So I'm completely astounded that I set my stuff down, and I actually set my iPhone on a trash container and left it there. I'm
incredible.
Beside myself.
Yeah.
That I would have done that.
It's amazing how.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, you know, that's my scary story for Halloween week.
You know, it's amazing how attached we get to these things. They have so many uses. I remember a few years ago I wrote for the Speculist about, you know, my dream gadget, you know, was something that could be like a PDA, a camera, a phone, a radio, an iPod, a pager, email, fax, coast-to-coast walkie-talkie, pedometer, calorie counter, internet device, and I want it all in one thing. Well, you know, pretty much all of that is in the iPhone and some other competing gadgets too. So I mean, it's we pretty much got what we asked for in that device. So of course
we did. But did you ask for some device that you would be completely dependent on? That's the
exactly. Something that we'd be completely useless if we didn't have. Exactly. That you know. I guess that's the downside of any great thing. If it goes away, you are completely and utterly without hope. So, anyway, glad you got that. Glad you got there with your bat and your laptop, and so pretty awesome.
Yeah, and
for you.
When I get home, I'm never leaving home again. I'll tell you.
Well,
definitely learned my lesson.
Awesome. Well, we got a few things to talk about tonight. I don't know if it's possible to hit it all in this Halloween show tonight, but some things are going to be scary fun, so
we're doing just a grab bag show tonight, which, considering the amount of planning we were able to put into it, I think that's going to work out well for us. But, you know, you have been blogging up a storm. You've been tweeting up a storm and blogging up a storm, so I thought, why don't we just hit some of these topics that you've been writing about? I've been actually delivering sales training all day, so I'm running out of voice, and now I've told my great story. So this is going to be, you know, this is another close to Stephen's stream of consciousness show, I think. We're going to let you take us through some interesting ideas. And I want to start with this. You did a follow-up post on the 100-Year Starship program, and apparently Brian Wong gave some more details. So what can you tell us about the 100-Year Starship program that we didn't know before?
Well, actually, several cool things are involved in this. And, you know, basically he was able to, you know, give us additional details of what this is about. Now, basically, your guess and my guess, you know, we hear a program that's associated with NASA and DARPA about a 100-year Starship program. Well, basically, what's our guess? Our guess is that, let's get on track to produce a Starship in 100 years.
In 100 years, yeah.
So what would? I mean, and I, based on the things we're hearing back, it's about, you know, how, you know, what the program is about now. It's you know, that's an optimistic end goal and some pretty normal aerospace type programs that they're implementing. Now there are some cool things that they're looking at. Basically, a microwave enhanced boosting to get into orbit. I think that's a pretty neat idea. Had you ever heard of that before? Do you know what I'm talking about, Phil?
Microwave based boosting, is that so from surface to orbit using microwaves?
Surface to orbit using land based microwave guns, basically.
I think Brian Wong has talked about this before, but why don't you refresh our memory on this?
Okay, you've got a rocket ship with propellant in it, but
okay.
It's a different kind of propellant than would normally be in a rocket ship. Okay, and you know it lifts off, but then you engage microwaves that are land based. Okay, to basically shoot at this rocket. This heats up the chamber or whatever, and basically it reduces the amount of propellant that you have to have on board, and therefore the amount of weight that you have to have on board. And, you know, anything that you can take off of the spacecraft and put on the ground that helps propel a spacecraft into orbit, you know, any energy that can be applied from the ground to get something into orbit is a good thing, right? And so, you know, you're getting additional energy from the ground that you wouldn't have been getting otherwise, and the weight factor is, you know, is actually negative because you can leave some of your propellant on the ground, and so it's a double good in that way, and so I think that's pretty neat, you know, And to me, the coolest thing that they're actually working on is part of this program now. Now, so, I mean, some other things also very cool, but, you know, how does this help us with the Starship program? You know, advanced blimp designs that, you know, could, you know, you can slowly move across the planet, but, you know, much faster than the old blimps could. You know, that's cool, but that's, I guess, I don't see how that really is an incremental step towards a Starship.
Here's my guess, okay? Let me guess something. So they've got this program where they're just developing totally cool things. Microwave rocket, super sleek, rigid, fast blimps. I mean, these are totally cool things, right? So this is the marketing thing. They needed to give it a cool name, so they called it the 100-year Starship, even though there's no Starship involved. Is that maybe what's going on?
Maybe, but I'm thinking, you know, it's also could be that they think, you know, that some of these things may be incremental steps towards that. And, yeah, it's marketing, but also, you know, it's good to have a lofty goal. You know, I mean, lofty goals are great. Even if you don't hit that particular goal, on the way, you're liable to – there's going to be surprises, and where you end up with projects like this, you know, may not be Alpha Centauri, but it's you could – you know, have some pretty interesting things come out of it. And, you know, electric airplanes. You know, that's pretty neat. And, you know, if you could actually have anything to clean up the air is a good thing. And if we can actually use, if you can get the weight of batteries low enough, that helps us on the ground too, doesn't it? So, I mean, all kinds of things. Yeah.
Well,
so again, does that get us to Alpha Centauri? Is that actually produce a starship? You know, these are pretty modest steps. And you know, we'll have to check back in 100 years, basically, I guess.
Well, part of it would be okay. Yeah, I would say it's great to have a lofty goal. It sounds like what they got is a lofty name. Okay, which is a good thing to have too. Don't get me wrong. I'm a marketing guy, so I can respect that. I guess it also depends on the time frame they're talking around these things, because if you've got a project called the 100-year Starship Project, and in the first, I don't know, 20 years, you want to get to electric airplanes and microwave rockets and super-fast airships, okay, well, maybe you're on your way. But if, you know, it's going to take 80 years to get to those things, I don't think on the final 20 we're going to get to a Starship. It seems like... It all has to do with what the time frame is around. You know, is it a 20-year fast blimp? Is it a 15-year electric plane? When do those happen? And what are the next phases? And how soon do we get to those? Because I'd like to think that they're really working on star travel within the next 100 years. And we don't know that they're not. All we know is that some of the things going on under the auspices of this project, some of the things that are part of this project with this name, are the things you named, right?
Right, exactly. So, anyway, and, you know, one would hope that there are things that are going on outside this project, too, that could contribute towards the goal. So, you know, like you say, it's a good bit of marketing going on, but, hey, that's okay. And so, anyway, I obviously we'll be watching this, and it'll be a fun thing to see what comes out of that.
They're all great ideas.
Blue sky projects like that.
Yeah, I'd love to see any of those things come to fruition. I'm particularly interested in electric airplanes. I think that's something that we will see eventually. So it's interesting to see that they're working on that. And I think it's very cool that they're talking about those other two ideas too. Obviously, airships are super cool, and anything anybody does with those is great. I'm glad to see progress on all those dimensions. So very cool. Okay, well, let's move on to our next topic, and I think this is really interesting. This business of writing in the margins. Now, you provided a note from the Rational Optimist. Oh, and I want to mention that our number of readers in our project to get 1,000 people to read the Rational Optimist has now increased, thanks to Peter Fritz, who left a comment to this post. So. We're gaining slowly, working towards our 1,000, our goal of 1,000 people to read the Rational Optimist under our influence. And you get full credit for this one, Stephen, because it was in response to your blog post. So way to go. We're We're up to, I don't have the spreadsheet in front of me, but we're up into the 50s now on the number of people, and looking forward to getting it to 1,000. So you're reading, or you have read The Rational Optimist, the Kindle edition, and as you're reading it, you're leaving your own notes in the margins, as it were. One of the benefits of the Kindle is that you can write notes to yourself the way, you know, you can in a hard, you know, actually hard copy version of a book. You can take a pen, and I've done this my whole life. Particularly, I did this a lot in college, is I would write responses, or I would write things that I thought I was going to be tested on, or just anything that really catches your attention. You say, man, that is so cool. I've got to capture that thought. Either underline that or make a little note about the fact that that idea has caught your attention. But with the Kindle, right, it's pretty open-ended, apparently. You can not only highlight particularly passages and say, oh, neat idea, but you can go in and you can respond to what you've been reading. You can actually add text to the book, as it were, from your own standpoint. And apparently it doesn't stop there. So tell us more about this notation feature in Kindle.
Well, you know, I bought a Kindle, you know, this is kind of an interesting thing. I bought a Kindle when the second version of the Kindle came out. What was that, about a year and a half ago? Anyway, I bought one, and like a month later, they come up with a Kindle for iPhone app, okay? And I said, well, that's cool. I'll go ahead and download the Kindle for my iPhone. I might use that from time to time. Turns out that that my actual Kindle device is gathering dust in a closet. Meanwhile, I'm reading on my iPhone all the time from the Kindle app, and I make my notes. You know, from there, I just type in the notes and make and highlight and everything else. The cool thing then is, if I want to like come back and maybe blog on an idea from a book, I just log on to Amazon, hit notes, and bang, I can see all the notes I've made on all the different books I've done, pull them up, and this is kind of a cool idea. Pull it out and write a blog post on it. Great, I love that about Kindle. I love that I can, you know, something that I, you know, some idea I had while reading a book, I can then pull out. You know, it might be 3 months later, I come across some article or something that, you know, triggers that thought, and I say, oh, yeah, I remember reading something, you know, that's related, and I pull it back out, and I'm able to use it that way. Cool. And that's cool. Love that. But then, you know, Amazon is only halfway there on this idea, though. They have the opportunity to create the next Twitter, the next Facebook for people who like to read. And they are, you know, they were so close, and maybe the reason they haven't done it is, you know, maybe some copyright issues or something like that. Maybe, you can't have people highlighting a whole book and then sharing it. You know, maybe there's something like that, that some reason has kept them from doing it. But think of how cool it would be if we could, follow people that were in, you know, that are, you know, I was thinking maybe somebody like Cory Doctorow. You know, we love his books, but also, I mean, he's an interesting guy, and he reads interesting stuff, too. So what if we could follow his notes on Kindle? And, of course, that would encourage us to buy these books on Kindle. And so, you know, it's a win-win for Amazon, so why not? Maybe somebody in your family, you want to follow their notes, or maybe even some guy and maybe your professor in a particular class, you could follow his notes to your textbook that you're reading from Kindle. Awesome stuff like that, or even have it set up where you could have like a note ranking system where you say, oh man, this is a great note, and you hit bang, 5-star. Well, it pushes that note up in rank, and then everybody, you know, reads the five star ranked notes, when they're going through their book. So, I mean, this, I think it's a great opportunity here for Amazon to really create a pretty neat social network, and for whatever reason, they haven't done it yet, but I just feel like that it's such an obvious idea that it'll happen. It's and looking forward to when it does. It'll be kind of a way that a book, in a way, doesn't have to be a finished product with something like this. There could be an ongoing conversation that, in a way, could become part of the book. I think the way we will look at books in the future is going to be influenced by exactly this sort of thing, and I look forward to that. It's going to be kind of a cool way of dealing with it. So anyway, that's my 2 cents on that.
This movement back in the early to mid 20th century, the great books movement, the idea of getting people to read what were considered at the time the great books of the Western world was the collection my dad has, and it's Homer and Aeschylus and Herodotus and all the Greeks and then the Romans, and then you get to Western Europe, you get to the Middle Ages, and then finally you get to the 19th century, you get to the 20th century, you got Adam Smith in there, and it's just this collection of kind of all of the great ideas as they were expressed in books throughout Western civilization, throughout Western history. Now, the whole great books movement kind of has fallen by the wayside. There's, academia has moved off in other directions, and these books aren't core to curricula anymore. But what's interesting to me about this is one of the I've read quite a few of those books, and I've read like the preface and kind of the containing material that surrounded these books in the collection my dad had. And one of the ideas that they promoted in there was what they called the Great Conversation, and that's what they really described the whole development of Western civilization as represented in these books as being. So,
but it's a very slow moving conversation when it's in, when it has to be on paper. You know, you could have a great conversation and, you know, that in the 19th century would have taken decades. You could have the same conversation in 6 months with this kind of technology, you know?
Well, sure. And let's be careful, because we're not saying it's the same. Because in this conversation, it's like, you know, you got Shakespeare responding to Homer, okay? Which, when it's Phil responding to Cory Doctorow, that's good too. I'm not sure we're quite at the same level, but what it lacks in that kind of absolute serious weight, in that gravitas, I think it makes up for in the fact that you've got this instantaneous response in a true conversation. You've actually got people responding back and forth, right? This has always been kind of a one-way conversation through time. One person lays an idea, then somebody else lays an idea on top of that, then somebody else lays an idea on top of that. And books were self-contained units. Somebody writes a book and it's done. And now we're talking about, no, now a book becomes a medium. A book becomes a means by which people can talk to each other. And in this instance, we're talking about the readers talking to each other, but potentially you can even have the author of the book involved.
Right, and you know, if the author of the book, you could have like author of the book approved notes. You know, I mean, if he likes particular notes, he could there'll be a you're not going to want to read through the book with everybody's notes. You're going to find ways of filtering notes. You know, these are people I'm interested in, and I'll read their notes. Or these are notes that have the weight of readership is said that are 5-star. So these are notes that everybody agrees are great notes. These are author approved notes. Lots of to filter it but the conversation would be instantaneous and that's pretty cool. It's a new way of looking at books.
It's absolutely a new way of. I mean, it really throws the whole idea of a book club, right? I mean, you could have free-form book clubs forming just around books. I'd love to get something like this going around the Rational Optimist. I think it'd be great for all of those of us who are reading it or have read it to share our thoughts on it. And this would be such a cool way to do it. So yeah, I'm pretty surprised that it hasn't occurred to Amazon. And I wonder if they're looking for a way, maybe not to provide that sharing themselves, but to have that provided over Facebook or Twitter or one of the other already existing social networks. Maybe that's how they'll deploy it once they figure out exactly how they want to do it.
I'm sure some smart people are working on it, but I I'm sure there's some legal issues involved too. But I think that the sheer utility of what we're talking about is so great that somebody somewhere is going to do it, and we'll see it done, and I think we'll probably see it done pretty quick. If I had to predict, I'd say we're going to see something like this done by somebody within a year. It'll be done. So let's so here it is. We're here at close to Halloween, 2010. Let's check back close to Halloween next year and see if we've got a book-based social network that allows people to share notes like that. So let's check back in a year and see.
We'll give you till November 1st, 2011. All right. So
okay,
I'm throwing a few extra days. Just
appreciate it.
Just to be sure. Yeah. Hey, no problem. Hey, so speaking of having conversations, this is kind of cool. I don't know if you saw the link that Ken put in the chat room, but talking about the Skylon project. If you follow that link, very cool article about airplanes in space. Unpiloted air-breathing vehicle that takes off and lands on a runway is the holy grail of aeronautics, because this is something that ought to be part of the 100-year Starship program. This is an airplane that takes off from the ground, achieves orbit, and they show a picture of it here. It's powered by two hybrid engines that can use oxygen from the air when available, or liquid oxygen when there is no air. So this is a very resourceful idea for an aircraft that is both an aircraft and a spacecraft. Looks like what they're showing here, the prototype here, would be unmanned, but it looks like a really cool idea for a piece of aeronautical/aerospace technology, and ought to be part of that. Ought to be part of that project. Anyway, thanks for sharing that, Ken. That's cool stuff.
Absolutely. Well, what did you think of that I was basically thinking about there? And this French commercial that I put that I posted. It was a YouTube video that I posted on the Speculus. It's a commercial by a French company that's a commercial for motor oil. And of all things, they show basically a robot foot race. Apparently, this one robot uses their brand of motor oil, and he outruns all the other robots around the world. And he comes back in and wins the race at the end. And I'm just looking at that, and of course, you know, obviously not caring at all about this particular motor oil. I don't even think they sell it in the States. But my question is, would somebody be interested in watching a race like that? And so I guess let me just give you that question, Phil. What about you?
Here's the thing. There's a couple of issues you have to explore when you ask that question. One is, how would you watch it, right? This has to be like Indy 500 coverage, only depending on how far of a course they're covering, this is going to be days and days. So it might be a whole TV series. It's going to be more like the Amazing Race. I mean, you know what I mean?
We're talking about a future where there's ubiquitous video. So just to you know, there's video cameras everywhere, and so you know, and you could probably follow any particular robot in the race that you cared to follow. But I mean, would people care though? I mean, these are robots that are running very, very much like humans. They look like, and their movements are very human-esque, and I'm sure in the way they created this particular commercial, I'm sure involved people in blue suits that they then overlaid robot parts on, you know.
That's a really interesting point. I wonder how they made it. I wonder if it was all just...
I think they had actual runners. Yeah, I think they must have had actual runners that they then over probably wearing blue suits that they overlaid the computer, you know, by computer overlaid the robot on. But I mean, let's imagine a future where we have robots that can run that way and they're that good. And I mean, do you care about robots that much that you would, you know, be interested in? And I think it comes, you know, we had a commenter compare this to, you know. You know, I don't like it. You know, it reminds me of car racing, and I never really cared for that. Well, NASCAR is about one of the most – I think it is the most popular sport in the United States. It doesn't appeal to everybody, like our commenter, but it appeals to a lot of people. And I'm saying I think this kind of race would be very interesting to a lot of people, and it could be a future sport.
I think it might. I think it's different from NASCAR. The difference being that when you look at a car in an automobile race, you say that driver's name. Okay, so you're looking at his machinery, but you're actually thinking about the driver.
Right.
And this is going to be one step removed from that. So when you see the robot, it's got to be the robot itself, right?
Right.
Imagine that NASCAR car had no driver, and you're bonding directly with the car. And you know, I mean, this is a difference. I mean, you would think, well, you'd be seeing the same thing. What if they? To wind the question back another way, what if they raced NASCAR without any drivers? What if it was all remote control or it was all computerized? Would people watch it? I think they might, but they'd have to be. They would be rooting in a very different way because now they're rooting for the car, not for the person driving the car. And so I think it's a question of how the extent to which people could identify with that car, or the extent to which people could identify with that robot. But I don't doubt for a second that people could empathize with, identify with, and root for a car or a robot, either one. I think for a sport like that to work, probably the biggest concern would be that you would have some notion that one, something real was happening, that it wasn't all just, you know, the guys got together and decided which robot was going to win this week, and two, that it would be potentially closely matched enough that you didn't know who was going to win, right? That somehow these robots have enough in common that there's a plausible opportunity for several, if not all, of the robots involved in the race to win. And it would actually be a surprise finding out who's going to win, the way it is in an actual race, you know. You would need enough of that element of chance, and you would need for people to look at those robots and actually identify with them and sympathize with them as though they were people. It's like the human interaction directly with the machine rather than the person behind the machine. But, yeah, I don't doubt for a second that could happen. I think you do get emotionally attached to machines. I was talking about the emotional reaction I was having to losing my iPhone earlier. You know, I think it's a very similar principle at work. And I think in the future we're going to watch robot sports. I don't doubt it. I think probably that's where NFL football will go, actually. it's too hard on the human body. We'll probably need to put robots in there at some point, which are more durable and they can.
Or at least cyborgs. You have guys that have completely replaced knees and other joints out there, playing. That might actually be the way it goes, you know.
Yeah, well, and that's one of those things. You couldn't have just one. Once you got one cyborg in the NFL, they all got to be cyborgs, right? I mean, it's like one has a tremendous advantage. So, I think the future belongs to robot sports. Not entirely. I think that we're still going to have human sports, but I also think we're going to have modified humans participating in sports. And I think watching machines compete with each other is just going to be part of a much broader spectrum of sporting events that are available both for participation and for watching than we can currently imagine.
Absolutely. Love it. Okay, well, I guess my answer to my own question is, yes, I would watch it. I would. I could get into that sport, and one of the reasons is, you know, you could have like college teams, you know, you could have MIT running their robot, you could have Stanley from Stanford, you know, or whatever, and you could have the guys behind the scenes explaining how they tweaked their robot this week and that sort of thing, and I think it could end up being a very interesting sport. So yeah, there's that. So. Don't think this is gonna. We're gonna see this in the next year. If I had to put a date on this, we'd need at least a decade, probably more, before you start.
Well, and there are robot competitions that occur today, but there's still very much people involved in those. And there have even been kind of early false dawn TV shows about robots fighting each other, but I don't think those have really caught on. And the technology is not quite to the point where we can truly identify with the machines themselves, and I think that's the chasm that'll have to be crossed before we'll actually be sympathizing with, rooting for, and anyone putting any money into making a regular spectator sport out of robots competing with each other. But you overcome those gaps, you close those gaps, and I think something is really going to happen.
Absolutely.
Maybe 5 years.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm going to stick with more than a decade, and let's visit back on this in 5 years.
We'll check
years
back in 5 years,
right.
See where we are. Okay, November 1st, giving myself the same leeway. November 1st, 2015. We'll check back in.
Guys in the chat room, y'all write this down. We'll get back on these things.
Yeah. We need.
All right.
Okay. Moving on. I want to talk about what I'm describing as the Lego Yularity. Now, has the Lego Yularity occurred? Are we now living in a post-human Lego-driven future? I saw the video. We've got the Maker Lego bot. Basically, you've got a as you know, you can make anything out of Legos, right? And so now here we've got a machine that lets you make your own Legos. So tell me, Stephen, what is this Maker Lego bot tell us about where we are in time and what's coming next?
Okay. This is a machine made out of Legos that's very much akin to a 3D printer. Okay, a 3D printer takes basically a goop and prints out much like a dot matrix printer, but in three dimensions, whatever design that you give it to print out. And the idea has been there have been several groups that are working on this idea that if we can print things out with one of these printers, why can't we print out another printer? And so we will make as many of the components as possible for a 3D printer within the 3D printer and get as close as possible to a machine that can reproduce itself. And then, you know, watch out, world, once that happens, you know, you've basically got a self-perpetuating money machine, basically, that can, you know, I print out, somebody prints out a machine for me, and then I print out one for Phil and for Ken in the chat room and Thuris, and you know, everybody has one of these machines that can print out anything, including another machine. And so that's an awesome idea, and there are people that are seriously working on that idea. Now, what they've done here with this particular Lego bot, it doesn't make Legos. I think you misspoke there just slightly, Phil. It assembles Legos. This is a machine that get in a CAD program and like design a Lego house, and like they did in this particular video, and then you shoot that idea into the Lego Mindstorms computer that's attached to this machine, and it goes to work and it builds out of Legos whatever you design. And, my thought is this. This machine actually might come closer to self-replication than a standard 3D printer. A standard 3D printer, provided that you're providing all the Legos for this Lego printer that it needs, it could assemble its component parts, I would think, fairly easily. Of course, now then, once there's the size issue of, well, you can only assemble a part of this particular size, and then you'd have to, you know, put those particular components together then. So it wouldn't be completely self-reproducing, and, of course, you have to provide the Legos, but it would come close in some ways to self-replication. And I'm saying that it's an interesting idea because it kind of comes at self-replication of a machine in a slightly different way than 3D printing, because instead of taking a standard 3D printer and using goop to make parts for another printer, you're actually starting with something that's made out of these standard issue blocks already, and then using it to assemble other blocks. So it's a slightly different idea, but it's interesting. And anyway, it might be that it's just a very interesting dead end as far as technology goes, but it's interesting nevertheless. So,
well, here's what I like about this is for one thing, we've got a good comment from Ken. He says you would need components with different materials like wiring to do this, and I think that's probably true. The
yeah, absolutely. You would need, for example, you need the Mindstorms little computer that looks like a lot like a kind of a largish PDA. That you know, you need that obviously. So you can't, you're not assembling that with this machine. But no effort at getting a machine to self-reproduce has been 100% yet anyway. So. Yeah, I give Kim that. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, here's to me what's exciting about this. I mean, aside from the fact that it's Legos and it's cool, which is a given. Okay, that's just cool. But what's exciting to me about this is that this is an assembler, and it is a universal assembler within a very limited universe. It's a universal assembler for the universe of which the molecules are Legos, right? And this is
exactly.
You know, this is a pretty well-defined universe, and we're all familiar with it. I mean, we know the world of things that can be made out of Legos. And actually, the possibility space for what can be done with Legos is something that's only being explored now. There's a lot you can do with Legos, and there's a lot of cool stuff that's been made with Legos, but that barely scratches the surface of all the cool things that could be made with Legos. But the point is, obviously, a Lego block is a huge macroscopic item. It's a big, chunky piece of something. But the concept of, imagine for a moment that a Lego block is a molecule, and here's a machine that can take, for that Lego universe, molecules and assemble them into any pattern that they can go into. That is your prototype for the universal assembler. You've got to have much smaller hands and much finer control to assemble molecules in the way that we're assembling Lego blocks. But the principle is actually there, and you know, for this massive, crude, cartoonish Lego universe, for this machine now to be in its first generation, speaks to a future age when we'll be dealing with much smaller particles. When the building blocks are not going to be nearly as big as Lego blocks, and I think there are probably a lot of intermediate stages between the Lego universal assembler and the true molecular universal assembler that we'll eventually see. But I think you're right, Stephen. I think that from a paradigm standpoint, this pushes us in that direction in a way that nothing I can think of that's come along before actually does.
Talking about the universe of possible things that can be assembled with Legos, I invite the folks that are listening to this to get on YouTube and search James May Lego House. Literally, a guy made a house out of Legos, and obviously the guy's insane. But his house is absolutely wonderful, though. I mean, we're dealing with.
Does he live in the Lego house? No.
I don't think it's possible for any person to live in this house, but it's a wonderful thing, and it's kind of like you know, this is something that you know, a true to life Willy Wonka would have come up with. I mean, it's a big house entirely out of Legos. So, James May, Lego house. So basically. You know, wouldn't it have been cool for this guy to have assembled this house out of a had some sort of robot building helping him build this house, so, multi-story dwelling here. At any rate, it's pretty fun. My inner child laughs at this. This is awesome. This is you know, grew up in love with Legos, Like you say, it's just there's a lot that can be done with it, and
it's a prototype. It's a proof of concept for things will come later. I've put the link up on the chat room, so follow that link and you can see James May's Lego house, the beginning of the true nanotechnology age as played out in the substrate of colorful plastic blocks. That's pretty astounding. Well, Stephen, I know we've got an unusually large amount of music that we're dealing with this evening. So should we stop here with our chat and move into that part of the program at this point?
Yeah, we could. Tonight we're gonna it's Halloween, and so what we're gonna do, I'm gonna play a brand new song that has a Halloween theme to it. The name of the song is Monsters by Common Ground. And then after that, I've got a couple of favorites that we've played in past Halloweens that I'm going, you know, we're going to I'll play after that. And so, at any rate, I hope everybody enjoys it. And you know, see you guys next week.
All right, Monsters from Common Ground and two old favorites. Speaking of old favorites, starting Monday, Fast Forward Radio will be heard three times a week, and we're winding it all the way back to the very beginning of the. Of this program on Blog Talk Radio. So the first ever episode of Fast Forward Radio, if you want to take that trip down the memory lane, that'll be on Monday evening. And we'll follow that up with our regular show at the regular time. And then next Saturday, we're going to begin rebroadcasting The World Transform. So hope you'll tune in for all of those. Enjoy that music. Thanks for putting that together for us, Stephen. Thanks, guys, for showing up in the chat room at an unusual hour. Great having you with us. Everyone listening live, and everyone listening, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. Hope you have a happy Halloween. We look forward to being with you all again next week. And until then, live to see it.
Wonderful phrase.
Cthulhu Pathagin!
say it and you're crazed.
It means Cthulhu rising out of the haze.
It's a prophecy we'll all soon see. Cthulhu Pathagan.
Cthulhu Pathagan, it's our way of life, it's our motto, it's our credo.
Oh, I hate that!
Hate what?
Han Solo clearly shot first!
Not Greedo, Credo.
Oh, sorry.
When he was an outer god.
When I was an outer god!
Yay! Dead Cthulhu waits dreaming no longer. He found that his form lacked a certain appeal. All his glistening pseudopods made blood congeal.
I'm a sensitive soul at the end of the day. And it hurts that my friend's flesh all melted away. And oh, the shame!
Oh, the terrible shame!
What a disgrace!
Falling from grace!
Till I decided to blame!
Whose fault was it?
The whole human race!
Yeah, what were they doing hanging around with an acidic mass of flesh-devouring polyps anyway?
Can I help it if I'm an ick magnet?
Hey.
Cthulhu Pathagan, now we're in for strange days. It screws up your noggin, turns planets into buffets. And great Cthulhu spans whoever obeys. So get off of me, you monstrosity. Cthulhu Pathagan.
Wait, he's gonna show up.
Cool.
It means Cthulhu rising out of the haze.
It's insanity for humanity. Cthulhu Pathagan.
Cthulhu Pathagan.
Cthulhu Pathagan.
Cthulhu Pathagan. I say Cthulhu.
And I say Pathagan.
If I said it backwards.
We need a toboggan. Cthulhu Pathagan. That was a lot of fun. Can we sing another one, please?
Oh, sure thing, my odoriferous pal. Hit it.
Tek-a-lee-lee, 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 tek-a-lee-lee,
tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee, tek-a-lee-lee. I can't hear you, buddy. Back me up. Abhoff? Ow, 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 ow. Oh, great Cthulhu. Ow, ow, oh, stop. Oh, it hurts.
People who acted as though they were in a kind of trance were killing and eating their victims, prompted authorities to examine the bodies of some of the victims. Medical authorities in Cumberland have concluded that in all cases, the killers are eating. Repeating this latest bulletin just received moments ago from Cumberland, Maryland. Civil defense authorities have told newsmen that murder victims show evidence of having been partially devoured by their murderers. Medical examination of victims' bodies shows conclusively that the killers are eating the flesh of the people they kill. And so this incredible story becomes more ghastly with each report. It's difficult to imagine such a thing actually happening, but these are the reports we have been receiving and passing on to you. Reports which have been verified as completely as is possible in this confused situation. Happening. It would appear that no one is safe. No one is safe. No one is safe.
I'm cutting off my phone and my Skype. Shutting down my computers and I'm killing all the lights. Keep your voice low if you want to make it through the night. Keep your head down. Avoid the windows. I don't assume that we're safe because we're not. I've seen this before. Kid is gonna get hot. If you brought a weapon, take it out. Show me what you got. If you see him, take him down. One kill, one shot. Say no joke, you know I always keep it real. Give yourself a gut check, got the nerves of steel. It's gonna get epic just like the tournament unreal. If you've been dipped in the sticks, better hide your heel. Remember that it's just a sweet expense. Just stick to the killing, there won't be a consequence. Take a look around, absorb the evidence. They're already dead, the plan ain't violent.
There's supposed to be another broadcast at 3 o'clock. 10 minutes. Oh, only 10 more minutes?
Don't doubt, this ain't my first time. Fight me and dead. And if I see one bite you, I'll put a bullet in your head. I become a ghoul. I'm in it to win it, so don't you take me for a fool. It's kill or be killed, yeah, that's the rule. But now the time for talk is done. It's gonna take all we got to get this war won. The killing's already begun. I look to the front and we're being overrun. Time slows down, everything goes dim. My buddy's got a couple trying to tear him limb for limb. I set them both on fire, now the situation's not so slim. But then I see him bleeding, damn, they got him.
Latest word also from National Press Services in Washington, D.C. now tells us that the emergency presidential conference, which we've just mentioned, will include high-ranking scientists.
If I were surrounded by 6 or 8 of these things, would I stand a chance with them?
Well, there's no problem. If you had a gun, shoot them in the head. That's a sure way to kill them.
My buddy goes down, a bullet in his face. At least I got to him before he joined the cursed race. I asked for someone else to come and take his place and tell me how much longer will we fight at this pace. I see my share of war, but this is something else. I'm running and I'm gunning in circles like carousels. I fire instinctively and my nerves are raw. And everywhere I turn, I see a zombie with a bloody jaw. This is a losing battle, they're gonna eat my brain. I can't believe I'm giving up, I must be insane. I wanna survive, but I can't maintain. Maybe suicide's a thought I should start to entertain. If this is a dream, tell me why can't I wake up? My friends all died before the military showed up. I keep pushing on, but I just want to give up. I'm at the end of my rope, and I just don't give up. Helicopters coming, tanks in the street. Soldiers everywhere, and they're all packing heat. Bullets and mortars, we want them in defeat. But the zombies keep coming, all grown into eat. Round 5, man down. There's nowhere left to hide, nothing left in this town. So much blood, you would think you'd drown. In all this, from sunrise till sundown. Now I think I'm finally gonna crack, cause the zombies keep pushing, so I gotta push back. I look for a weapon so I can join the attack. I find a crowbar, then my vision goes black. As I'm falling, I can hear him talking. I'm gonna die, so the zombies come flocking. I'm being eaten by these undead lunatics. I grab another character sheet and roll 3 more d6.